Good afternoon. House Education and Finance Committee will come to order. And today we're going to resume our discussion of the governor's budget, but we have now, I have introduced the legislative package that encompasses the education portion of the governor's budget, House File 890, and that should be in your packets. And so first we'll hear from the department, and then we will move to public testimony, which we will do for the remainder of today's meeting and tomorrow's. But before we do that, we should probably move the minutes. See, Representative Mariani, would you like to move the minutes from our last meeting?
And sure, I would so move.
All right. Representative Mariani moves adoption of the minutes from the January 26th? February 1st. Thank you. Meeting, any questions? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Mariani. And with that, welcome, Dr. Melcher, Mr. Uni. We appreciate you coming back. And is this your third time in a row, maybe, Dr. Melcher? We're glad to have you here. And again, if you would each just introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Adosh Uni, Director of Government Relations at the Minnesota Department of Education.
I'm Tom Melcher, Director of School Finance at the Department of Education.
So, Madam Chair, members, Madam Chair, first of all, thank you very much for carrying the Governor's 2017 Education Budget Bill, and thank you for the opportunity to present on the bill language after the Commissioner was able to present on it already. So just to walk through, this will be a short walkthrough. The bill is not extremely long. Many of the provisions are very straightforward. So starting on page 1, on section 1, that covers page 1 and 2. Section 1 is on voluntary pre-K programs, so it clarifies the requirements for voluntary pre-kindergarten programs around literacy skills for English language learners, measurement of kindergarten readiness, services provided, and teacher training. The changes will require programs to have licensed teachers by the year 2022-2023, the school year. It requires programs to be supervised by a licensed administrator, including elementary school principals, and clarifies that school readiness aid may be used to supplement voluntary pre-kindergarten programs. Moving on to Section 2, which is on pages 3 and 4. This eliminates obsolete language around voluntary pre-kindergarten applications. It makes Minneapolis and St. Paul districts into two separate buckets for any new pre-kindergarten program. So that creates 5 overall. The program as it exists is 4 buckets. St. Paul and Minneapolis are in the same bucket. This would split them out into their separate buckets to reach more more schools with high concentration of poverty. It clarifies that student counts for mixed delivery sites may generate from a specific school site, provided those children are prioritized for service. And then it creates a participant cap on the program rather than an aid cap. On page 5, section 3, pertaining to the participant cap, it provides that the voluntary pre-kindergarten program is based on the participant cap rather than the aid cap again, and the cap is 8,300 participants in fiscal 18, and then 1,000 more each year in years after that.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. Section 4 on page 5 increases the general education formula allowance by 2% in fiscal 18, an additional 2% in fiscal 19. That would add $121 per pupil in the first year of the biennium and an additional $124 per pupil in the second year. Section 5 on page 6 of the bill would increase the equalization factor for the operating capital levy in order to neutralize the levy impact of the increases in the voluntary pre-kindergarten program. Section 6 of the bill would increase the pension adjustment component of the general education revenue to offset the cost of the school districts, charter schools, and cooperatives of the increase in the employer contribution rate for Teachers Retirement Association and the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Association. The increase in the pension adjustment revenue would be equal to 0.5% of the prior year salaries for fiscal 18 and 1% of the prior year salaries for fiscal year 19 and later. The bill does put a cap on the amount of state aid that would go out under that provision, which is $22,851,000 in 18 and $45,703,000 in the second year of the biennium. It requires the commissioner to prorate the aid if the salaries would generate more than that amount. Section 7 sets the payment schedule for the pension adjustment revenue at 100% in the current year rather than 90-10. And then Section 8 of the bill are the appropriations that would be reflected on the tracking sheet that Ms. Adrians has put together. Moving into Article 2, Section 1 of Article 2 is adjusting the cap for the QComp program to include the additional enrollments in the voluntary pre-kindergarten program for those districts that would be adding pre-kindergarten under the governor's recommendations. No new districts would be included in QComp, but this would allow the districts that come into the voluntary pre-K program to include those enrollments for pre-K in their QComp calculations.
Madam Chair, Adosh Uni, Department of Education. On Section 2, which is pages 10 and 11, this is language around the appropriation for the Bureau of Indian Education Schools. This makes permanent the increase per pupil to $3,230. On Section 3, on pages 11 and 12, this is a replication of the 2016 Support Our Students grant program. For those that are unfamiliar with the grant program, this provides funding for schools, or for districts, charter schools, and intermediate districts to hire school counselors, school psychologists, school social workers, school nurses, or chemical dependency counselors. The grants are for 6 years, and schools that have no positions are prioritized. Recipients must do a one-to-one local match for the first 4 years, and then for the last 2 years, a 3-to-1 local match, and then the recipients must report back to the commissioner on the impact of the grants. Section 4, which is the appropriations on pages 12 to 19, this includes what is on the tracking sheet from Ms. Adrians, but it also includes the funding for tribal contract schools, full-service community schools, and Support Our Students grants.
Madam Chair, members, Tom Melcher. Article 3 begins on page 19 of the bill. These are the changes that I spoke with you when I was last here to review the special education funding recommendations. Section 1 on page 19 deletes some obsolete language. It also excludes expenditures that are funded with the pension adjustment revenue in Article 1 from eligibility for state special education aid. It would increase the growth cap for the special education formula from $140 to $171 over the old law formula for fiscal year 2018, and it would raise the annual growth cap from $40 to $43 per ADM for fiscal 19 and later. Section 2 in the special education article would simplify the calculation of special education initial aid by removing the formula based on old formula expenditures, which would change the calculation from the least of three amounts to the lesser of two amounts. It would also increase the state percentage reimbursement for the pupil-driven component from 56% of the amount generated by the pupil-driven formula to 57%. And it would change the other aspects of the pupil-driven formula to reflect the cost study that I reported to you when I was last here. Section 3 of the bill would require the department to create procedures to adjust the base funding for school districts where costs have been reduced because programs are closed or a substantial portion of the program is transferred to a cooperative. Because the funding is based on prior year data, if a program closes, we keep funding it, and we want to make an adjustment so that doesn't happen. A good example is the Mesaba Academy up in Buell that closed. That there's base year data for that would continue to fund them as if the program had still been open if we didn't make that kind of an adjustment. Section 4 of the article would increase the aid percentages for the excess cost formula. There are two aspects of that, the portion based on non-federal special education expenditures, the percentage reimbursement would grow from 56% to 57%, and the portion of the formula based on old formula costs, the subtraction for general education revenue would be reduced from 2.5% to 2% of general education revenue. Section 5 is the appropriation section. The governor's recommendations would increase special education funding by $40 million for the biennium. And the repealer section, Section 6, would eliminate obsolete language dealing with allocation of special ed costs by cooperatives and the cross-subsidy reduction aid that was only in effect for fiscal 14 and fiscal 15. Moving to Article 4 of the bill, Article 4, Section 1 is the governor's recommendations for debt service equalization that I believe are also being carried in the tax bill. This would lower the threshold for school districts to qualify for second-tier equalization, which is the higher state share equalization, from a 26.24% tax rate down to a 22.34% tax rate in fiscal 18 and down to a 19% tax rate in 2019 and later. This would increase the state share of school debt service from 3% to 5.6% of the total levy, and the number of districts receiving aid would grow from 40 to 61 school districts. Section 2 is the appropriation section that would go that, and this is increasing the appropriation for debt service by about $20 million for the current biennium.
Madam Chair, Adoshuni, Department of Education. Moving on to Article 5, which is on nutrition, which is one section on appropriations, page 26 to 27. The governor is not proposing any increases there. Article 6 on libraries, it's the same, pages 27 to 28, Section 1, appropriations. Article 7, early childhood and family support, Section 1 is pages 28 to 29. This expands the eligibility for early learning scholarships to birth to kindergarten entrance. Currently it's ages 3 and 4. This will extend it to birth to kindergarten entrance. Section 2, which is pages 29 to 33, this is appropriations. This includes funding for the transformation zones and the education partnerships. Moving on to Article 8, Community Education and Prevention. This is on page 33 to 34, Section 1. It's the appropriations, and there are no new appropriations here. Article 9, Self-Sufficiency and Lifelong Learning. It's the same on page 34, Section 1, appropriations. There are no new appropriations for the governor's bill. On Article 10, our state agencies, this is Section 1, pages 35 to the end of the bill, page 37. Section 1 is appropriations. This will include the governor's proposal for funding for the department, the mainframe at the department, the online IEP framework, Help Me Grow, Board of Teaching, Minnesota State Academies, and the Purpich Center for Arts Education. And with that concludes the bill walkthrough. We can stand for any questions, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Shaman. Any questions from committee members? Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very quickly, probably a no-brainer question. I just want to make sure. So Article 3 and the special education pieces, those are all the task force's recommendations that were presented the other day. And so the question is, these pieces are they're interlocking pieces, right? We're not talking about one piece that works if we don't do the other piece. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Belcher.
And Representative Mariani, yes, there are several interlocking pieces of the special education funding formula. The governor's recommendations increases several pieces in order to provide increases to most school districts across the state, where basically the larger the cross-subsidy, the larger the increase would be. And it was actually a department report that was required by statute rather than a task force that reported that updated data.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Melcher, could you tell us why we're deleting, to the extent practicable, on line 1.21 under program requirements for a voluntary pre-K? That has to do with native language and literacy skills of English learners.
Dr. Melcher, Ms. Rooney.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Erickson Doshuni from the Department of Education. The purpose of getting rid of the language on 1.21 is enhancing the requirements of the program to provide these services, especially when it pertains to giving instruction through play-based learning to foster children's social-emotional development, other skill levels, as well as native language literacy to English language learners.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Rooney, does that mean that we have instructors or persons who know the native language to work with our children?
Mr. Rooney.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I might have to phone a friend on this one for...
Let's just have Ms. Burnham come down. Thank you. And if you just please introduce yourself for the record.
Bobby Burnham, Director of Early Learning Services, Department of Ed.
All right. And do we need to repeat the question, or you got it?
I have it, Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative, this is to be much more intentional about this requirement and to ensure that all teachers have the necessary skill set available to meet the needs of all learners, regardless of their language, native language. So it's not eliminating that requirement. It's enhancing it and providing more intentionality around it.
Representative Erickson.
That still sounds to me like we're going to have more of persons who speak a particular language interacting with these children. Mm-hmm. Am I off track on that?
Representative, Madam Chair. It's just to provide a greater skill set of all. We are working intentionally to provide, you know, it's not a matter of having a native language teacher in each classroom. It's providing training so all teachers have some skill set to meet all the needs of the native language learners, regardless of what classroom they're in.
Representative Erickson.
Yeah, finally, Madam Chair. So are these like community experts that you're anticipating, at least in our old teacher licensure law, who would be involved, or are these volunteers?
No, this is our intent, Madam Chair, sorry. Representative, this is our intent to ensure a more robust training for all early learning educators.
Madam Chair,
we'll talk offline.
Madam Chair, I would just like to add, and Representative Erickson, teachers having skills in native language and literacy skills, especially for English language learners, was one of the core components of the LEAPS Act that was passed in 2014. So this is following in the footsteps of providing supports and enhancing that requirement around our pre-kindergarten program.
Madam Chair, I'll talk offline because I think this poses perhaps some difficulties, certainly in rural Minnesota, but we'll work it out. Thank you.
Thank you. No questions. I had one. Mr. Rooney, just a question. I know when the governor's pilot program was approved and funded in the supplemental for the voluntary pre-K, we did take the required licensed teacher language out of that, and I see it's coming back. Just a question or a concern I have with the teacher shortage and supply and demand report that continues to show we've got a severe and growing teacher shortage problem. And I'm wondering how that factored into the requirement of utilizing licensed teachers, because we do allow flexibilities for school readiness programs, and some of these dollars can be combined. And if you could explain just sort of the governor's and the department's thinking on this. Or Ms. Burnham, whoever would like to take that.
Madam Chair, so the governor has a strong desire for this requirement in this language, and it's mainly due to allowing the state of Minnesota to align with the national trend around the requirement of licensed teachers, following several recommendations from the National Academy of Sciences report, We also have a strong desire to keep the pre-K program since it's now a part of the K-12 system, in alignment with the K-12 system. And as you know, one of the requirements is around comparable salary. And we've heard a lot from early childhood educators from throughout the state about that comparable salary piece, as well as gaining an overall respect of their profession. And we feel that this requirement will put the path forward for that to happen by the year 2022.
Yeah, so the year 2022 is pretty quick. That's just 5 years from now, I guess. Have you had any analysis on maybe how various parts of the state may be able to accommodate this? My concern would be if this is, school districts are applying for this and it's limited by the number of students and that we can accommodate, are we going to be having some districts who maybe, again, are in teacher shortage areas, maybe in rural areas, that could be prohibited from being able to participate in this preschool opportunity with that requirement?
Madam Chair, we are in the process of creating a survey to gather information from currently funded programs. We do know that from the funded programs last year, every site but two stated that they would use licensed teachers. That doesn't say that there wouldn't potentially be a shortage, but we do not have current data to state what that shortage area would be per region, but we tend to get that.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hate to be a nuisance, but under special education, a couple of questions. First of all, Dr. Melcher, to what extent does the department lobby the federal government to bring about a more equitable share in special education? Because we're $388 million short, according to this. We need everybody on board to be equalizing that. So to what extent does the department do that?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I'm not aware of formal lobbying that we have done to particular committees. I do know that we make our national representatives and senators aware of the crucial need that we have in special education and the cross-subsidy that's driven by the federal government. So our members of Congress are well aware of the issues that we face. However, I have not engaged formally in any letter writing to any committees or anything like that. I know the commissioner speaks about these issues with other chiefs around the country, and I know through their organizations, I'm sure that they're making the federal counterparts well aware.
Member Erickson.
Yeah, so to that extent, I communicate with them, but with the Congress. But again, we have a higher special education standards, so we are, as a state, driving the cost. So I think we need to pay closer attention to that as well, because the federal government, and I shouldn't say the federal government, the Congress is probably reluctant, as was Representative John Klein, to increase if we are going to exceed the federal standard. And besides that, the congressmen and women see a growing array of extra special needs, and I think they're concerned that there are other things that could be done perhaps to prevent all of this identification. And I'm not saying it's not needed, but perhaps there are steps we could take. So with that, Madam Chair, I have a question about, will these increases or even the present amounts listed on page 21 in lines 24, 26, and 28 include the use of assistive technology that I don't think our districts are using enough of to meet some of the needs of these special needs children? So would they be able to, meaning the districts, use that average daily membership served for that amount, like 12,700 for autism spectrum disorders, developmental delay, and severely multiple impaired? Can we use any of that to put toward the technology that, especially I think in this group, our children could benefit? Is that allowable?
Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, yes, if you turn to page 20 of the bill.
20, okay, yep.
Just to provide a little background, this is in current law. The definition of non-federal special education expenditures means all direct expenditures that are necessary and essential to meet the district's obligation to provide special instruction and services. So that would include assistive technology that's required. So we're essentially giving them a block grant. They're getting, you know, X amount of dollars per student, and then
they make the decision.
They make the decision on how to use it. Some of the funding is based on a reimbursement of costs. Some of the funding is based on number of students.
Thank you for that answer. And Mr. Uri, could you find out from the department how many districts do use assistive technology actively in their programs to assist our children? I've been interested in this area for a long time, having carried some bills for our senior citizens who need this. But now it's come to my attention that, you know, with our children loving technology, and I in fact, had some of the archaic assistive technology when I taught back in the 90s, but I would like to know just to what extent the district knows or the department knows that districts are using this and how we could be enabling more of that use and perhaps reducing some of our counts, because these children will find success in many of these pieces of technology. Thank you.
All right. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions really quick, and I think some of this will probably come out in some of the other testimony, but Article 1, Section 2, we have the participatory cap concept in lieu of the aid cap. Can you say a little bit more about what the logic is, about what is the advantage of doing that? What are we going to be moving forward as a result of using a participatory cap as opposed to an aid cap?
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Mariani, I think the thought behind the participant cap is that it's a little bit more straightforward at the time the requests are approved. We know exactly how many students will be participating in the program and what the cost will be. Under the current law, we have a cap on the dollars, and then what we do is we have a requirement to prorate at the end of the year if we end up spending more. So we estimate how much it's going to cost per child. We've approved a certain number of students. So this year we have 3,300 students that are approved. But at the time we approve it, you know, we don't know exactly what the free and reduced lunch concentration will be. We don't know what the exact cost will be for some of the facilities remodeling that's being done. So we've got kind of an error ratio there, and we've got districts in a difficult position where they don't know at the time that they're approved whether they're going to be fully funded or whether they're going to be prorated at the end of the year. And if they are prorated, it would get very complicated because the proration requires us to go into the general education program, the special education program, the school lunch program, all of the different programs that we'd be affected, and we'd have to do a calculation at the end of the year, which would be very difficult both for the department and for the districts to budget for if they don't find out about it until the year is over. So with this kind of an approach, we would budget based on the number of students, 8,300. We come up with an estimate of what the general education funding is. We have a pretty good idea about the numbers of those that are going to be free and reduced lunch or that are going to generate different kinds of funding. And it becomes more of a forecast program based on the number of participants rather than this kind of prorating at the end of the year if the numbers turned out to be a little off.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Melcher. I suspect we're here from some school districts of, you know, the advantage that this provides mm-hmm. for their stability relative to offering this program. Article 1, Section 1, there's the school readiness, the ability to access the school readiness for the VPK. I'm wondering if, again, a quick sharing about what the thinking is in terms of what is the advantage of being able to do that. I mean, obviously, there's another flow of money, so that's pretty obvious. But what else does that bring to the table relative to the offerings of school district by being able to combine with school readiness funds?
Burnham.
Madam Chair, Representative, Many schools and many programs are currently blending several funding streams, including school readiness, including early learning scholarships, and including voluntary pre-K money, and it allows them to grow their program and offer potentially more hours of service. And the other reason we put that there is we've gotten some feedback from currently funded BPK programs around the ability of elementary school principals to supervise voluntary pre-K programs, and it's stated in the school readiness statute that they currently aren't allowed to supervise school readiness programs. So we put that in there in order for elementary school principals to oversee the entire early learning program. And that's, you know, regardless if it's funded by voluntary pre-K school readiness or early learning scholarships. And we are currently in the process of ensuring that elementary school principals have the training and background in early childhood development in order to help them be more qualified to do that.
Representative Mariani.
And then, Madam Chair, thank you for that, Ms. Burnham. And then, would this be accessible, under this proposal, would this be accessible for charter schools as well? There are charter schools that are, there's a few of them that already have their foot in the door with BPK, looking a lot at early learning opportunities. Does this framework allow for that as well?
Ms. Burnham.
Madam Chair, Representative, so charter schools currently, to be eligible for voluntary pre-K, need to get their authorizer agreement amended to be a state-recognized pre-K program.
So, Representative Mariani.
So, Madam Chair, so if they do that, then does this language then open up the ability for school readiness access, that access to those funds in the delivery of those comprehensive programs?
And Ms. Burnham.
Madam Chair, I do not have the answer to that question right now.
Madam Chair, Representative
Mr.
Mariani, we can certainly look at the impact of what that language would have. That's obviously an important consideration. I'm seeing if Dr. Melcher might have the answer right now. Okay, it looks like we're not sure right now, but we'll certainly respond with that. With that answer.
To provide that to the committee, that'd be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Judy.
Thank you. And Ms. Burnham, you might want to stick around a second. Just a question. And we have posed this before, and I believe the department is working on it. But one of the questions we had asked when we had done a hearing on the VPK pilot program operating, and now with a discussion about expanding that. And capping it. It's currently serving, I think it's 3,300 children that would go up. Do we now have a handle on how many of those children were not receiving services before, either under school readiness or a scholarship or some other program that we have available to them?
Madam Chair, yes, I know that we have been working to figure out how to collect that data. It's not currently being collected. It's going to have to be collected through a survey process. Our data systems just aren't set up currently to go in and ask that question and get the data fed back to us.
Okay. Thank you. I think that, again, is something that's important, especially as we do allow the braiding of funds, and with the question that Representative Mariani posed about the school readiness. I'm just curious as to, you know, how closely aligned those programs may be, or if the schools are operating two distinct programs, one under school readiness and one under BPK or not. The addition of students, or is it addition of hours? Both of things I think are important for the committee to know and to consider. You mentioned something about having an elementary school principal have sort of being overseeing these programs and that, and you're working on getting the training and background for principals in early education. Do you know right now how many of the schools in the pilot program, the VPK with the $25 million, have that background? and how many across the state might have that as the proposal is to expand the program?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question. Currently, elementary school principals oversee the early childhood special ed program within their building, so they do oversee some pieces of the early childhood program. We are offering what we are calling the P3 Professional Development Leadership Series, and currently we have worked with over 90 school districts to train elementary school principals and their teams, along with superintendents and some of their educators, around early childhood development and creating an aligned pre-K through third grade system. How many of those particular 90 are VPK sites? I would have to find out. I do know in our third cohort, we are focusing on recruiting only VPK sites to ensure that those particular sites have that pre-K through third grade training and learning.
And how extensive is that professional development? What's involved in that? Is there a certain number of hours or courses required?
Madam Chair, it's a three-part series. So series one is around leadership competence. So it's basically focused on elementary school principals and growing their background and knowledge base in early childhood development. Series two is around educator competence, so it's working with early childhood professionals, educators, and staff around growing their competence in pre-K through third grade alignment. And series three is around the system building component, so that is superintendent-led teams that work on building a coherent pre-K through third grade system. And so pre-K has been a focus of all three learning sessions. Each session is 5 days long, and we are trying to have conversations around trying to get some official authorization or notification of this series being some sort of certificate program for elementary school principals.
Thank you. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Ooney, this is a question about counselors. Can you tell me how many counselors will be added with this budget?
Mr. Ooney.
Madam Chair, Representative Poston, yes, I can. With the $4 million over the 6 years and also accounting for the administrative funding that we get to the department, roughly around 30 counselors or other support staff would be covered by this, and this would be this would account for Metro and Greater Minnesota. There's a requirement to, as much as possible, be able to do an equitable placement of those. And as well, we've seen from the 77 positions that we had from the prior funding from last year, they were split between full-time contracts and part-time contracts.
Representative Poston.
What is the ratio of counselor to student right now?
Mr. You know,
I don't have the exact number on me right now. I know that we're above the national average. That's why the governor is placing a great emphasis on continuing this program, and we've seen a great demand for it. I know that the demand in the elementary setting is greater than the high school setting. I can certainly pull up those numbers for you and get back to you as soon as I can.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, Representative Poston asked pretty much the question I wanted to ask about the Support Our Students grant program. I note that there's new policy language here. I actually really like this language because it really talks about a comprehensive, at least as I read it, it speaks to a comprehensive placement of competent professionals that cut across different fields, obviously including what we traditionally think of as school counselors, career counselors, etc. But, you know, we've got school psychologists, social workers, school nurses, et cetera. That seems to be a pretty powerful concept, and I don't as much have a question than as much as just and I suspect we'll hear some more from testimony, as much to, you know, kind of throw kudos out to the executive branch on being able to capture that development of what it takes in any given setting, in any school, to get the right combination of professionals. Obviously, in some kind of a broad counseling capacity, obviously we need a lot more than what we currently have. But anyway, thank you for the my thanks to the executive branch for thinking through this and developing, I think, a much more comprehensive way as opposed to just throwing, you know, one professional class into each school, but really doing it in a much more relevant way in which students experience whatever issues they're experiencing in whatever school they're at.
Mr. Ernie?
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I'd also like to take the opportunity to say I think the governor and the commissioner really saw the value from the bipartisan effort around this proposal last year. So I think, we took the lead from what came from last year. We saw the demand through the application process and saw that this is a winning proposal.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about, as we're sort of working with a lot of early childhood, basically that 0 to 5 population, how does the Office of Early Learning work with the Department of Human Services or the other organizations or agencies that work with that same population that's being served?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Burnham.
Representative, so actually quite well. The Race to the Top grant provided the agencies the opportunity to collaborate on multiple levels in multiple projects. So even though the Race to the Top has ended, that collaboration still continues. We meet monthly as a leadership team with the directors and some managers, supervisory levels from the Departments of Human Services and Health. And the Children's Cabinet is working hard to ensure that we continue those conversations. Parent Aware is a project that we collaborate on weekly, you know, with across the Department of Ed and the Department of Human Services. Home visiting is another initiative, as well as health and developmental screening. All those initiatives, each agency kind of plays a role in, so it's very important that we communicate and collaborate across those communication lines.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Loon. And then I just have another question on there's $600,000 to Minnesota Department of Education to implement voluntary preschool, and I guess I'm just wondering what that is spent on when there's already, I think, $925,000 to implement the scholarship program. I don't know.
Ms. Brown.
Madam Chair, Representative. So adding BPK is like adding a grade level. And so part of that money is spent on staff time. We pay for a full-time staff in the Division of School Finance. We pay for a staff member in my Division of Early Learning Services. A big chunk went to a minute to revise the data systems to be able to take in the BPK data. And we put money in there for evaluation of the BPK program, as well as some technical assistance and professional development opportunities for such as the P3 Leadership Series. We've done a lot of work through Race to the Top, and I think part of this money is ensuring that the work that we have, the groundwork that we've laid regionally can be sustained. So some of that money is creating professional learning communities in each region. We hope to build stronger partnerships with the centers of excellence, even though, you know, there is no early learning money in that bucket right now, but we're really working across those lines to make sure that early learning community is represented in those centers of excellence. I have my budget back in a notebook. I can grab it to see if I've forgotten anything, but it's money being well used and needed.
Ms. Pierce. All right. Other questions for representatives from the department? All right. I'm not seeing any more, so I think then we will move on to taking public testimony. Thank you all very much for being here. And I assume that, obviously, if we have questions along the way, you will hear from members. And we are anticipating a little information requested through the questions already. So with that, thank you. All right, so we had a number of people that signed up to testify, and again, we'll continue tomorrow. So anyone that doesn't get a chance to testify tomorrow or today can tomorrow. But I would say first, if there's anyone who's traveled any distance who can't come back tomorrow, we want to make sure to get you in today. So if anyone's traveled a number of miles, why don't you please go ahead and join us. All right, and welcome. I have a list, but some people I don't know you by face in that, so I'm just going to ask each of the testifiers, please just identify yourself with your name and your affiliation if you're with a group or an organization at the beginning of your testimony. And we'll ask people to keep it to about 5 minutes or so to keep it fair to everyone or less. And afterwards, we'll open up for questions. So welcome.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. I'm Shannon Neal. I'm a family physician. I practice in St. Louis Park. I'm the chair of family medicine at Park Nicollet and a faculty physician at the University of Minnesota Department of Family Medicine, and I also represent the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. I'm speaking in support today of broadening the Help Me Grow program in Minnesota. As a family physician, I see firsthand how difficult it is to make connections between families and community resources. When we as providers identify a child with needs, often the barrier to their care is knowing what the resources in the communities are. Most medical practices don't have the capacity to be able to catalog what's available in the community and to keep up with changes. Even those who have the luxury of having a care coordinator find the coordinator doesn't have the capacity to be aware of all the resources. Most often, parents are unfortunately left to search for ways on their own to help their child. It can be a full-time job advocating for your child, and families with children with special needs are already strained. They're often just managing to get through the day. To add the burden of searching for resources for your child is overwhelming. I have personal experience with one of my own children. Even though I'm a physician myself and know the medical community, as well as having access to resources in my health plan, it still took me months, frankly almost a year, to finally get connected to the right type of services for my child. To have had a centralized source of information would have been invaluable to me, saving me not only emotional time and energy, but also time lost from work. I'm aware that expanding the Help Me Grow program takes resources. There have been numerous studies, however, that show that early access to services can decrease healthcare costs, decrease problems with the juvenile justice system, increase high school graduation rates, and decrease teenage pregnancy. I'm urging you as a physician and a parent to support broadening Help Me Grow in Minnesota to help improve connections between families and resources in our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Neal. Any questions for Dr. Neal? All right, I think you're free to go. Thank you very much. All right, and welcome.
Hi, Madam Chair. My name is David Heisted, Director of Research for Bloomington Public Schools, and I'm going to be in Washington reading grants tomorrow, so I appreciate getting in today. The purpose of my testimony is to share, and I do have some handouts for members, to share information on the effectiveness of early childhood programs in Minnesota, in particular Bloomington. I worked for 25 years as the director of research for Minneapolis Public Schools and did a number of studies there showing the effectiveness of pre-K. This particular study has evidence from our four-year-old program. Minnesota has we're very fortunate to have researchers in the area of early childhood, in particular Scott McConnell and Michael Rodriguez, professors at the University of Minnesota, have developed an instrument specified for four-year-old students that's developmentally appropriate for those students that identifies needs in the area of phonemic awareness, alphabetic principle, vocabulary, and comprehension. Now, we use that assessment to show progress. There are benchmarks for fall, winter, and spring. So in Bloomington, we give the assessment three times, and we looked at whether our students improved in terms of their performance, the percentage of students hitting the proficiency standards, and it turned out that we went from 29% of the students who were proficient in the fall of the year up to over 60% in the spring of the year. And then we did a second study that looked at how did these students do when they got into kindergarten compared to a matched sample of students with similar demographic characteristics and similar mathematic scores. And it turned out that we had a statistically significant impact for our pre-K program for students that were enrolled for the whole year. So this is the type of analysis that we will do with our volunteer pre-K program this year, and we'll be able to bring back results to the legislature on the effectiveness of the pre-K program. We developed a beginning of kindergarten assessment in Bloomington, which is a combination of the Minneapolis beginning of kindergarten assessment and the Bloomington kindergarten assessment, taking the best items. And it turns out that that assessment predicts future reading in first grade and all the way up to third grade. So we can predict with pretty high confidence whether students are going to be proficient on the third grade Minnesota Comprehensive Reading Assessment. And so I just wanted to assure members that we do have assessments in place and that we will be able to report back effectiveness. And so I support the expansion of the voluntary pre-K program and would want to make sure that we have good results to show for that investment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Heistad. Any questions? Representative Gavney?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd be interested in seeing Dr. Heistad's data if we could.
Yes. The pages, you can go ahead and pass that out to the committee.
Thank you very much.
All right. Other questions? Dr. Heistad, do you know, and I'm assuming your data is just on the programs you're operating in Bloomington schools, correct?
Yes, this particular study was on Bloomington schools. I do have studies from my previous district, Minneapolis Public Schools, if committee members are interested. But this particular program was highly diverse. Over 50% of the students were students in poverty who received free and reduced price lunch when they got to kindergarten, and a large percentage were English language learners. And it turned out that the results were robust, so that it wasn't just in a certain group that benefited from the results, but across racial ethnic areas, poverty, English language learner, all of those groups showed significant increases.
Thank you. And were most of these, I see from your slide now, for four-year-olds. So four-year-olds in a, I'm assuming, a school year-long program?
Yes, a school year-long program. And this year we have the voluntary pre-K, and we're doing the same type of assessment, and we'll be able to report back progress within the year and also then do follow-up studies to see if this large advantage then continues in first grade, second grade, third grade.
Thank you. I think the committee would find that to be of great interest, so thank you for providing this. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Safe travels.
Thank you.
All right. Is there anyone else who is here today, cannot be here tomorrow, or has traveled a distance that would like to testify today? If not, I'll just start calling out people that I have on the list. All right. So I'll just start doing that. And these are in no particular order, but Scott Kroonquist, Association of Metropolitan School Districts. And on deck, I have Sarah Clark with Mini Minds, and Jamie Dukowitz, college counselor with Robbinsdale Armstrong High School with the Minnesota Association College Counselors. So just letting you know what order we'll be going in.
Okay.
Welcome, Mr. Kroonquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few words about the governor's proposal. I'd like to start out by thanking the governor really for the level investment that he is in, proposing. We think the $604 million proposal really is a robust but not extravagant in any way proposal. In fact, if you look, Madam Chair, members, at the projected surplus right now, this would represent about a 42% share of that, and that in fact is the share of the E-12 budget in the state of Minnesota, so there is a nice alignment there, we think. I would highlight a couple of items that are top priorities on the AMSD platform. The general formula allowance of 2 and 2, we are very appreciative. Our platform actually calls for 2.5, 2.5, which, as you know, is the projected inflationary level over the next 2 years. So we would certainly be happy if it was bumped up to that as we move forward. But we thank the governor for coming in with a solid proposal there. And then the special education, which you have had a couple of good discussions already this session, and I think you are all very aware of the impact that a special ed cross subsidy has on school district budgets. So anything we can do there really helps provide relief to your schools. We're also very supportive of the debt service equalization proposal. We're happy that it actually is moving in the tax bill, though, as well, and would prefer to see that be the vehicle that it's used as, and that you wouldn't have to take it, Madam Chair, out of your target. While it's incredibly important, it really is more of a property tax issue and property tax fairness and tax equity. And so we would hope that it would be carried in the tax target, and then that we could also build on actually what the governor is proposing to have an even more robust debt service proposal, and then also extend it to the operating referendum, where is another area where we've lost ground to inflation over the years, and we really could stand to see some enhancements. I'm going to try to keep it brief here. The other item that we really would like to single out, though, that we're appreciative of the governor putting forward is the pension funding. I think you're all aware that the TRA is facing a significant unfunded liability that really does need to be addressed. But we are very much in need of the state following through with that employer increase. Our school districts are not prepared financially to handle that, and so we appreciate the governor putting that money forward. One area I want to mention that's not included and where we will be talking to you is continuing to address the teacher shortage, and particularly the teachers of color, just an area that we really have to address, and so we'd like to work with all of you on that, and also making sure that we can bring our teachers who are in the concurrent enrollment programs up to the credentialing standards that they are going to be required. So that's just one area I wanted to get on the record, as we're hoping that we can address as we move forward. I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Kroonquist? All right. Thank you very much. Let's see. Sarah Clark, is she here? No. Oh, maybe she's coming tomorrow. Okay. Jamie Dukowitz? Jamie, yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jamie Dukowitz. I am a college counselor at Robbinsdale Armstrong High School. I am here with MACAC, the Minnesota Association for College Admission Counseling. I have been a counselor for 17 years at Robbinsdale Armstrong High School. In that time, I have seen a great increase in student personal, social, emotional issues, as well as a more challenging college admission system for students. And at our school, we are currently at about 400 students to one counselor. The national ratio for representative, the Minnesota ratio is we're at 743 students to one counselor, which puts us at 47th in the nation for school counselors. So we are definitely lagging behind in that area. I was fortunate enough, or I should say my school district was fortunate enough 7 years ago to receive a smaller learning communities grant to add my position as college counselor. which helped decrease our ratio. That now with budgetary constraints is potentially going away, which then we would go back to having 500 students to one counselor, which makes it very challenging to meet the needs of both our students and our families in our school district. So I am here in support of the $4 million increase to the grant proposed by Governor Dayton.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dukowitz. I appreciate you being here. Questions for this witness specifically? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dukowitz, the counselors that you work with, the 400, or the one counselor to 400 students, do they get to counsel?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. Not as much as I think they would like to. We are caught up in things like testing and other activities that we don't get as much one-on-one time with students as probably necessary. So it's band-aid approach, it's triage, it's reactive versus proactive due to the numbers.
And Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Dukowitz, in the time that they get to counsel, that's a percentage. Is that a major part of their assignment, though, like 60-40 or?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I would say under 20% of our time goes to the counseling with the student.
And Madam Chair, you said that counseling the students and their families, out of this 20% then, how much of the time is spent with families?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, even less than 20%, it's, you know, 5%, depending on the situation, meeting with a family after school, potentially. As college counselor, I am able to spend more time with families who have questions on the college side, but the other counselors do not have as much time as I do to meet with the families.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
And Ms. Madam Chair, this is more dismal than I thought it was going to be. But so you mentioned testing, that part of their time is testing then. What other kind of duties does the counselor do before they can participate in the counseling part of their job?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, there are so many things that counselors are charged with that has increased in my 17 years. 504 education plans, scheduling students, the college and career area has become more and more, there's more and more that counselors need to know and to pass along to students. The personal social, the coordination of things like students with concussions, students with anxiety. There's so many more things, and it feels like that's the only spot where that goes is to the counseling department. You have to handle and work with those students and those families and the teachers to try to help create the best educational experience possible for students. So it is one of those things where I feel like our plates were already full, and they just continue to get more and more full as time goes on.
Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Mr. Dukowitz. Concussion? Do you work with the nurse on that then?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. Yeah, when students, there are more diagnosis of students that have concussions, we work with the school nurse. But then that student potentially either misses school or ends up going on a part-time schedule, or we're working with the teachers to make sure that the student is getting the assignments, the homework, the teaching. They're missing a lot of school days based on concussions, and the number of those incidences have increased. And I don't know, I don't think it's an increase in concussions, it's an increase in the diagnosis of concussions. That it's just, that's one of the things that in the last few years has become more relevant at our high school.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Dukowitz. Don't give up.
Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Dukowitz, I would concur. I've got a couple of other questions, or members asking questions, but just could you give us more information when you say testing? So are you proctoring standardized testing so that the teachers don't have to be in the classrooms when that goes on or in the computer labs, or can you be more specific about that?
Madam Chair, there are multitude of tests that are out there, including the ACT test. So I am in charge of administering the ACT test to all of our junior class. So that is coordinating that as well as the students that have special testing. We have the MCA test that the counselors are in charge of. We don't necessarily always are the ones proctoring those exams, but we are in charge of getting the tests together and making sure that everything runs smoothly. Our school district runs MAP testing. There is the PSAT test. There are all sorts of access tests for English language learners. All of those tests fall to the guidance department, the school counselors, to administer. And for some, for the PSAT test, I am the proctor of, 190 some students.
And do you know if that's the practice that you have at Robbinsdale Armstrong High? Is that the same that most other school districts, how they operate as well with their counselors?
Madam Chair, no, not every school district runs it exactly the same like Robbinsdale Armstrong, but I would say the majority of high schools, the testing does fall on the counseling staff. Some school districts are fortunate to have more support and so that they can have people that take care of the testing, but I would say we're in the majority when it comes to the testing for counselors.
Thank you. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dukowitz, in your experienced professional opinion, what is the right ratio for counselor to student?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative, the American School Counselor Association recommends a 250-1 ratio. 350 sounds more reasonable, I would guess, but it's hard to say. In my capacity, 400-1 has been a challenge. 500-1 is kind of unimaginable, but it's hard for me to say. I think the more support staff you have, the better, because it seems like there are more and more issues that we have to work with. So
thank you, sir.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dukowitz, do you also administer the ASVAB? The test typically that's given for military, but is a really good indicator of aptitude and skill sets that students may have.
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have not given the ASVAB at Robbinsdale Armstrong. Our sister school, Robbinsdale Cooper, has administered that test. That is, the counselors do not administer that. They help set up the test, and then it is administered by other personnel. But we have not done that at our school. Part of the reason for that, I think, is sometimes our students feel over-tested. They feel like there's all of these tests that they have. It certainly is on our radar as a potential test, but it is not something that we've done at Robbinsdale Armstrong.
So, when Representative Murphy was asking you about actually, counseling to address the future of the students, so then do you use the ACT basically as your indicator for how you counsel students for their future, whether it might be on the job, or a 2-year or 4-year?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Madam Chair, Representative. We do use the ACT test to help counsel students. Years ago, we used to have the plan test for 10th grade students that we would use that a little earlier in the process for students. We also have a computer-based program at our school called Naviance that we use to help students that has career in college. It has some career inventories in there that help students. We look at the transcript, we look at the GPA, we look at the classes students have taken. We look at everything we can to help to advise those students on what would be the best career path for them.
So, Madam
Representative,
thank you. So, Mr. Dukowitz, does that inventory then get shared with the parents so they also have an idea of what or the guardians their children might be seeing in this program or learning about their futures?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative, that will go home with the students, and if the students share that with the parents, that and, you know, I think you know how that goes sometimes. As a college counselor in my current role, I try to do nighttime activities for parents to come on conference nights, those kind of things to help inform parents. And I get a decent turnout, but not as many parents as I would like.
Well, thank you. That was very interesting.
Representative Sandstead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Dukowitz, are you also responsible for kind of overseeing some of the surveys that students take outside of, like, standardized testing, like the Minnesota Student Survey and other interest inventory type of surveys?
Mr. Dukowitz.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we are in charge of administering those through advisory, our advisory program. We administer surveys, student surveys. We also have, at our school, we have Schoology, so we do use surveys through Schoology to help kind of get a gauge on what students, where students are at.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was sitting here as you was asking questions about counselors, and I couldn't remember the name of the young women who came to visit me today, who was talking about counseling. So so I met with the Minnesota Association for College Admission Counseling, right? And here in the state of Minnesota, there's one counselor for every 743 students, right? It's huge. And they also shared with me that there is a lot of testing that goes along with the counselors, along with a lot of administrative work that goes beyond being able to have the ability to connect with students around career and in college. And so the numbers here are staggering, you know, 1 to every 743, which is above the norm around the country, which is still high, but it's a little bit higher. But I just wanted to share that because I know that was questions that we had.
Thank you. Let's see. Other questions? I have just one, and then I'll let you go and we'll move on. But so one of the things I've been wondering about in looking at our funding formulas and this question and others is, do we know, and maybe you know in your school and you may not, but if your school directs any of its compensatory funding for hiring counselors? Right, my first question. And second of all, it seems like, as you have illustrated, I think, very well for the committee, there's a lot of different roles on your plate, a lot of different duties in that. And I've asked this before of counselors when I meet with them. It seems like there's some distinct needs that our schools have, and some would fall into what I would call more kind of maybe social worker kind of counseling, and then there's sort of what am I going to do with my life after high school counseling, and you do all of those things. And so my second question would be, do you think that works well, that we have people doing all of those things, or is it more advantageous to have you focus on more the college and career readiness aspects and have other staff that focus on more maybe students who are struggling or have mental health needs or other things that they may need some counseling services for?
Madam Chair. The first question, the compensatory money, we do not, at my school district, to my knowledge, use any compensatory money towards school counseling. I think it goes to other areas. And to the second question, I'm not sure what is the best way to deliver services. I feel sometimes like I am, and I work closely with a lot of my college colleagues. At college, they have three or four departments that kind of handle about the same thing that the high school counselor handles. So admission, career services, personal social, academic advising, all of that falls down on the counselor. And I think any help, I mean, why I am a counselor is because I want to help students. And so whether that's me helping them with college and career or personal social, or if that's the social worker helping with something or the psychologist, just helping kids get through high school and that's what's important to me. So who delivers it doesn't, I think, matter as much as that we have the opportunity for students to receive services.
Thank you. And it was a hard question, and I think there's no right or wrong answer to that. It's just one of the things that I think we'll grapple with and wrestle with a little bit on this committee. Representative Depp.
Madam Chair, just to share with you in the committee, a few years ago, the St. Paul Federation of Teachers negotiated in their contract to have education assistants take over the administration of the standardized tests, with the recognition that you don't have to be a school counselor to administer, to handle the functioning of the test, and that then freed up the school counselor to do the counseling. Now, this was with the previous school board, and if memory serves, always a big asterisk there, if memory serves, the school board did not follow through on that, which I think is bad on them. But I think that was both a good administrative move in terms of administrating the test, also a good use of collective bargaining of the teachers stepping up and saying, we're going to use our position at this bargaining table to benefit our students, because I think that would have benefited the students.
Thank you. That's an interesting piece of information, Representative Dabney. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Dukewicz. You've been very generous with your time. We appreciate your testimony.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you. Brad Lindell, I know I saw him. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lindell with Schools for Equity in Education, and also Minnesota School Social Workers Association, Minnesota School Psychologists Association, and the Minnesota Administrators of Special Education. So we'll cover them all today. We really want to thank the governor for coming out with a budget target of $600 million. I think that's a good place. I'd like Mr. Kroonquist, it's a good place to start. I don't know how we can go above that, but I think the 2% on the formula is something clearly that we support strongly, so probably our top priority on the funding side of the equation. The increase in special education aid from both MASA, or from both MACE and C, very, very important. I think they were transitioning from one formula to another, and that $40 million in there is going to help smooth out that transition, because there is some dislocation of dollars as we move from one formula to another. Having the pension adjustment outside the basic formula, I think, is also very, very positive. Using a pension subtraction to handle that makes more sense, I think, and is going to make life a little bit easier for school districts throughout the state. As far as the pre-K goes, I think that there are some there is interest on the part of C to do some of the districts to involve themselves more in pre-K. But as we do that, I think there's also a need for probably more flexibility. We have several districts that would like to use a center-based model as opposed to a site-based model, so they could be more efficient in delivering those services. But again, that hasn't been a high priority for us. But we certainly, if this body goes forward with pre-K, to make it as flexible as possible. Also, the debt service equalization. Really want to thank the governor for that move in that direction. I think that, you know, the again, as Mr. Kroonquist said, we've been working with AMSD and with MREA on putting together a larger equalization package. We really like the fact that this is going through the tax committee and through the tax target as opposed to the education target. One of the problems I've had in my many years of dealing with property tax equity is that the tax committee says it's education funding. The education committee says it's tax relief. We'd like to find a place, I think, where both sides can come together and say there needs to be greater tax fairness for low property wealth districts, and I think that the governor's move to have this discussed in the realm of taxes is something that we find very, very welcome. From the social workers and school psychologists, we really do want to thank the governor for his indication of putting $4 million more into the Support Our Students grant. We've been working closely with the counselors and with the school nurses and trying to put together, show that these teams in local districts are needed and that it's not a competition between the organizations, but the desire to put together strong teams that will meet the needs of all students. The teacher shortage, as Mr. Kroonquist said, I understand that, you know, as we move forward with the report or the recommendations of the teacher, how that's going to be governed and the licensure system is going to operate from this point forward, I think there might be the opportunity there to talk about some of the things that we can do and the needs in local districts throughout the state to alleviate that shortage. Other than that, from Mesa's perspective, I think the thing we've talked about, it keeps coming back, the online reporting system for special education. There's uncertainty about that in some sense because unless we do a 25% paperwork reduction, whatever we do in terms of reporting really doesn't make any difference. As, you know, in a crude metaphor, if you just paint a 55-gallon drum a different color, it's still a 55-gallon drum. And so we want to have a gallon jar, not a 55-gallon drum, when we're talking about paperwork. So I think as we move forward, we certainly want to weigh in on those issues. And again, I really thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Lindell. Questions for him? Anyone? All right, thank you. And then Mr. Carter, Melvin Carter, did you want to testify? Oh, your physician was your testifier. Gotcha. All right, is there anyone else who's here who doesn't want to come back tomorrow who would like to testify? We have time. All right. Please come on down. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Sue Abreholden, Executive Director of NAWI Minnesota. I had something canceled, so I'm here, so I might as well.
Glad to have you.
Just really a couple of things. The big thing is really supporting the governor's increase to expand the use of school support personnel. We think it's important to have school nurses and school social workers and counselors and psychologists and chemical dependency counselors. And when we look at kind of the needs of children, we need the school support personnel along with the school-linked mental health at the top for the kids who have, you know, very high needs and need clinical services. But the two work so closely together. So as we work to increase school-linked mental health, we also need to increase our school support personnel so that we can really help all the children. So that was really the only comment I had today, and appreciate that that's included in the budget.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. And just a quick question for you. When I was meeting with some superintendents today from the northwest part of Minnesota about this, and there were questions raised. Do you know in terms of the, and this has not been funded through our committee, although I was prepared to do it in the supplemental last year, but Health and Human Services did take on that increase in the mental health grant. Mm-hmm. In terms of the availability of community-based providers and availability to our school districts, could you comment on that and on, you know, the adequacy or lack thereof as we look to try to give schools more help? Because as I travel around, whether I'm going to an urban or a suburban or a very rural school district, the increasing incidence and request for help with mental health services for students is probably the number one comment I get no matter where I visit.
Madam Chair, I would agree. It's a huge issue. I actually did a 40-city tour of Minnesota last fall. Everywhere, International Falls, Bemidji, Windham, you name it, I was there, and really heard that same thing, that we have kids who really need help. My understanding from the Department of Human Services is we're in about 85% of the school districts and not quite, maybe 42, 44% of actual school buildings. And when we looked last year at the percentage of, within a district, the percentage of schools they were able to reach, there were only really just a few that were in like 90% of their school buildings. So we are absolutely not there yet. One of the problems that some of the school mental health providers have, particularly in rural Minnesota, particularly in northwestern Minnesota, is actually the lack of personnel, that even if they were to get more money, they don't have enough mental health professionals. The loan forgiveness program that was increased through the Department of Health budget actually helped a lot in terms of bringing new people in. And we also found that there's a federal glitch that we're actually working with our U.S. senators on. So if you, as a community mental health center, get certified to be able to help with federal loan forgiveness programs, you cannot have that mental health professional outside of the clinic more than 8 hours. And so if you're at a clinic trying to do school-linked mental health, you really have a difficulty then because 8 hours isn't enough to be outside of the actual clinic wall. So that is something that we are working on because obviously it doesn't make sense for Minnesota to not, to only keep people within the clinic.
Thank you. All right. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much for coming down. Appreciate it. All right. Is there anyone else who would like to testify today? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Denise Dietrich from the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak to the governor's budget proposal. First of all, a couple of general comments. We want to thank the governor. I think that this is a well-rounded proposal that really reflects Minnesota values and and is a great benefit to the number of students that we have show up every day for public education in our state, which we all know is about 850,000 students on a daily basis. We think the target is close, very close to what our public schools need to provide high-quality education for all of those students every day. $600 million may sound a lot to a lot of people, but as I just mentioned, that is really what a good education bill will require. Many of the provisions in his bill reflect the Minnesota School Boards Association's policies positions this year, and so I would like to just comment on a couple of those. And the first would be is raising the per pupil funding formula by $121 per pupil the first year and $124 the second year. I think that that is a good step. As you may know, we are a proponent of at least inflation, and so this gets us close. And we would like to see it closer to the actual inflation rate. The other piece there that is very valuable to all school districts and all students in the state, actually, is lowering the cross-subsidy on the special education by about 3%, and that is very helpful to the state, and so we were grateful for that. We appreciate his work on pensions, of taking over the employer portion of that with state funding. We, as many have said before, we don't feel like that employer portion should be coming out of the classroom. And resources going in promoting and strengthening the school district's positions on trying to improve and make positive progress on the world's best workforce goals. That is, a requirement now of every school district in the state, and anything that we can do to strengthen our school district's position in trying to make positive progress on their own world's best workforce goals is greatly appreciated, especially with the reauthorization of ESSA right around the corner and what that is going to mean in order for local school districts and the resources that they're going to need in order to move the needle in their school districts. There were a couple of items that I wish was in the proposal, and I'd like to just comment on those. As many people have already mentioned, the teacher shortage issue. We still think that we need to be very aggressive in addressing the teacher shortage in the state of Minnesota, and we hope to work with this committee on that issue in the near future. The other issue that we have been talking about over and over again, just a small item, but it is, but something near and dear to our heart, is the telecommunications equity aid piece. It's a small amount of money, but the benefit to school districts is valuable, especially some school districts that benefits more than others. So I consider it still one of the largest inequities in our state. And then the other piece is the QComp issue. You know that MSBA has had a strong position on lifting the cap on QComp. And once again, I think that is just one of those inequities that continues to exist in our state, and we need to solve that at some point. And I'm hoping that we can address that with you in the future. And last but not least is there are no grants for funding innovation in our state. And local school districts are dying for the opportunity to try innovation within the current system and to provide more flexibility and funding for school districts to be innovative. In my opinion, if we had school districts provided the flexibility and the funding that they need, that research would be extremely helpful right now in trying to create our own ESSA plan. We need to go to our school districts and say, what can we do differently so that when we get the flexibility, for example, from the federal government, we have research in place that says, yes, this is what we can do and this is how it would work. And we'd still have accountability, we'd still have transparency and more flexibility within our school districts. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my comments.
Thank you, Representative Dietrich. Representative Poston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This isn't a question for the testifier, but I think a question for Mr. Strom. Mr. Strom, how does our per pupil figure compare to other states? Do you have that information? I mean, can you give us any of that information?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, it might be helpful for me to pass the buck to Mr. Melcher on this one, okay, as well. But our general support as a state-funded program is higher than most states. Most states rely more on the property tax. But we also have more components to our system than most other states as well. So I'm not familiar. Dr. Melcher might have a number of how many districts are higher on sort of their basic pupil support. I guess we're toward the higher end, but not by a lot, would be my guess.
Okay, we'll invite Dr. Melcher down. I see he's got more information for us.
Madam Chair and members, Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. I would concur with what Tim has said. When we look at annually, the National Center for Education Statistics produces a report that shows the overall operating spending for schools in Minnesota compared to other states. And we come in just about the national average. So in total, our school finance system is producing about the same amount of money per student as other states. But we know that we're well ahead of the national average when it comes to the state share of funding, which comes primarily from our general education formula. And other states are relying more on the property tax than we do. We have more of our money in the general education formula.
Representative Wilson. Thank you. Don't go away. I think we have a couple questions. I'm sorry.
For Ms. Dietrich.
And Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dietrich, how much would we need in the innovation area in dollars to fulfill what you're thinking about when it comes to flexibility for our districts?
Representative Dietrich.
Madam Chair, we have somebody in the audience who is an expert in that area, and I would like to call on them. Mr. Heisted.
All right, Dr. Heisted, you're back down. Thanks for not leaving yet.
Madam Chair and representatives, Bloomington and a number of other districts are supportive of the Innovation Zone bill for this year, and it's an opportunity for us to do research on new ideas. In addition to the program improvement that we all do in districts, it's nice to think out of the box and to be able to try something different. So it's more, I think it's more of the case that we would be using flexibility in resources rather than a large dollar amount that we would be asking for. We'd be asking for some monies for the Department of Education to be able to manage the Innovation Zone application process, and yet, at least from Bloomington's point of view, my superintendent, Fujitaki, is in the audience here. The two of us have talked about the flexibility of using funds like extended day funds in different ways rather than, you know, a large dollar amount allocated for innovation. So that's my perspective. Other people may have other opinions, but we look forward to putting in an application for an innovation zone if it is passed this year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dietrich, is it? I'm sorry, I had to step out of the room when you were introduced, but I heard most of your testimony. And you mentioned addressing the teacher shortage. I'm just wondering if you have any suggestions or any ideas or recommendations that you'd like to share with us.
Ms. Dietrich.
Madam Chair, Representative, MSBA is working with many of the other educational organizations right now as we speak and getting a draft, a Teacher Shortage Act to get drafted, and it has it will have many provisions in it. And just to give you a flavor of what some of those provisions would be, would be first of all to enhance our teacher loan forgiveness program and our stipends for student teaching. We have right in the bill we will also lift the cap on QComp because, as I mentioned, in my opinion, that is one of the biggest inequities we have in our state right now, is that one school district gets $260 per pupil for staff development type and staff enhancement type activities in their school district when another school district doesn't get that. So we are looking at alternative pathways to licensure to address the shortage of CTE type instructors. So I, right offhand, I think that those are a couple. And there are more, though.
Well, the one that I didn't hear, and maybe it's one of the other, the more that, that you're talking about, is teacher reciprocity with licensing. Is that something that your organization is also pursuing?
Madam Chair, Ms. Representative, Dietrich. Yes, we have been supportive of that for quite a while, and we would be very supportive of speeding up that process. It is my understanding that the Board of Teaching has engaged in those types of relationships with other states. It's just a very lengthy process right now, but that would be something that we should be talking about as well.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Then I'll ask one. So, Representative Dietrich, in looking at sort of the innovation and providing schools with that, I've heard comments about flexibility and money, and maybe flexibility is more important, or the ability. So if you were to wave a magic wand, how would we make the school funding that districts currently get more flexible to allow for more innovation in their educational approaches?
Madam Chair, thank you. Well, there are some suggestions, and I think Dr. Heistad just brought up one, is the school calendar, and for example, extended day to provide more flexibility in that. Extended day is something that I recall the legislative auditor has said actually does help close the achievement gap, and so flexibility in that, flexibility in different, you know, budgets and that type of thing. So I would have to think about that a little bit longer just to make sure that whatever I do suggest is respectful.
Yes.
Respectful. You can say a lot of things, and those are wishes, because yes, when you bump up to, yeah.
No, understood. It's a good discussion to have, because I'm I want schools to be able to try things, and I think that's very important that we allow innovation. I think that is a contributing factor to some of our teacher burnout or perhaps the shortage is that teachers aren't free to exercise sort of their creativity in coming up with new ways to do their jobs and to reach students, and that's, I think, a component that we don't focus on a lot. But a lot of times these requests are on top of everything else we're doing, and that's, as you know, presents budget challenges to this committee and others, so just trying to look at some of those issues.
Yes, Madam Chair, if I may, the teacher shortage issue is a very complex, multifaceted issue, and it will take a multifaceted approach. And so you're right, that is part of it as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if there are no other questions, we will end committee for today. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Tomorrow we will resume public testimony on the governor's budget proposal. We are adjourned.